This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah wa ba'd. So let's begin with the dua. We ask Allah to help us to benefit from the things which are said and to take that which is correct and to benefit from it and to discard which is incorrect and to leave it. We ask Allah to open our hearts and minds to understand this topic and to be able to understand what the true perspective of Islam is on it. Ameen. So, let's begin. How many of you is your first time at IAOC, by the way? Anyone? First time? A few guys? Okay. Alhamdulillah. It's good to see you guys. Welcome. Alright, so the topic is Islam and feminism, confrontation or cooperation. And I've taken this title actually from an article by Dr. Lois Farouqi, which I'm going to be talking about in the course of this presentation. So we have about an hour. So I actually prepared about maybe 10 hours of material. So this should be a seminar actually, but we're going to have to restrict it to 1 hour. So just try to understand that there's not as much we can cover in 1 hour than we can cover in 10 hours. So just keep that in mind. All right, so first of all, let me start with why am I speaking? I got a lot of people inquiring and saying, but you're not a woman, so why are you speaking about feminism? And I guess I understand where that question is coming from. So let me give a little bit background. The way that our Friday family night programs work in the mosque is that they set a date for different people who are going to be speaking on that date. So Sheikh Muhammad Faqih has a date, I have a date, Dr. Imad Bayoun has a date. And when it comes to myself and Sheikh Faqih, we have to basically give a lecture on a topic that we choose on the date that we're assigned, either once a month or once every other month. So I was assigned a topic, and I've spoken on different topics, you know, in the past months. I've spoken about, you know, Thomas Jefferson and the Quran, and I've talked about cryptocurrency and just different topics. So I figured, you know, this would be an important topic which I've been asked to speak about several times. And I don't think too many people are actually addressing this issue in the Muslim community, at least specifically, you know, from the Muslim scholars that exist. They don't really tackle this topic head on. And there was one auntie in particular who regularly attends IAOC and is one of our students. And she really encouraged me, and she sent me an article by Dr. Lamia. And she said, you should read this article and you should really address this topic. So alhamdulillah, unfortunately she's not here today because she's on vacation. But I know she's going to be watching this video afterwards. So she really motivated me to do that. So that's kind of how this topic was chosen. So they said, you know, well, why didn't you have a woman come and speak about it? Or why isn't there a woman on a panel, and why didn't you make a panel? Honestly, we don't put that much preparation or thought into how our Friday family night lectures are going to go. We choose a date, we choose a topic, and we say, okay, someone should address this topic. You know, so like when I presented on cryptocurrency, it would have been nice if I had like an expert on cryptocurrency or a professor of economics, you know, there present with us, reflecting on the economic aspects as well. But that's just difficult to organize, and it just takes extra effort. And that's pretty much the simple reason of why we didn't really do that. Okay, so that's the simple reason. The second reason is because it's actually very difficult to find women scholars who are scholars of Islam and then can give a take on feminism from an Islamic perspective. And when I say scholars, I mean at least someone who has studied about a decade of Islamic studies and has a good, rounded, deep understanding of the religion of Islam and all its different sciences. It's kind of rare to find those people in terms of the women who are there. And the ones who do exist, and there are some who exist, they're either extremely busy, because they're traveling around the country giving lectures everywhere else, because they're in high demand due to the fact that they're they're a rare asset, or they're unwilling to speak about this topic because they're actually afraid that it could destroy their reputation of speaking on a topic like this, right? So I'm just conveying to you some of the realities that exist in our community. And then lastly, I don't want to keep going on for a long time, but Dr. Sherman Jackson is another reason why I was motivated to speak about this topic. So he mentioned in a program that we had, I was at the ISNA conference one year, and he mentioned something. He was talking about juridical empiricism and, you know, going into a detailed concept. And then he said there's a trend, and I didn't understand this a decade ago. I was listening, I didn't fully grasp what he's saying, but I understand it now. He's saying there's a trend that exists in the intellectual milieu or the intellectual culture in which we live, where you are not supposed to talk about a topic unless you have direct experience of it. So you're not supposed to speak about women's rights unless you're a woman, because you don't know what it feels like to be a woman. You're not supposed to speak about the black community or the African American community unless you're African American, because you don't have a direct experience of what that community is going through. And he critiqued this idea, and he said this idea, although it's nice, you know, it's nice to have someone, and it's important to have someone who's from that particular community, you know, representing what the sensibilities, the sensitivities, the feelings of, you know, those people are on the topic. He said, imagine if we were to take that to its logical extreme. That means that someone who's talking about drug addiction should not be speaking about drug addiction unless they've been a crack addict in the past, or unless they've been a heroin addict in the past. Someone who's talking about addiction to smoking or the harms of smoking should not be speaking about it unless they've been a smoker in the past. Someone who's talking about pornography should not do it unless they've been a porn addict in the past, et cetera, et cetera. So that point really resonated with me, and that gave me, you know, an understanding that, you know, I'm not claiming to know exactly what it feels like to be a woman. That's not what I'm trying to do here. But at the same time, you know, I've been studying Islam for a very long time. And my goal is not to talk about what it feels like to be a woman in this talk, but rather it's about analyzing the feminine discourse, the feminist discourse that exists within our society, and looking at that from an Islamic lens and seeing how that kind of fits into Islam. Okay, so that's kind of one disclaimer. Disclaimer number two is that, you know, I'm open to discussion on these topics. So if somebody doesn't agree with me, if somebody says, you know, you're way out there, you know, if you decide to leave, I'm going to mention this in the beginning, in case you decide to leave in protest or something like that, just know that I'm open to discuss these topics. You can discuss it with me, we can make an appointment, you can meet me, we can, you know, meet somewhere, and we can continue to discuss these topics, okay? So if you don't agree, that's perfectly fine. I'm open and I'm willing to talk about these issues more further, inshallah. So let's begin with what is feminism, okay? So who thinks they know what feminism is? Who's pretty confident that they have an understanding of what feminism is? Just raise your hand. So there's nobody in the whole audience that knows what feminism is. No, just it's okay. Okay, so there's, I'm just trying to see. So like 20% of our audience feels comfortable in understanding what feminism is. Is that about accurate? Okay. Who would like to answer the question, what is feminism? Anybody? Yes. Okay, it's an aspect of bringing women's rights to be in equality with men, but not in competition with. Okay, good. Anyone else have a different definition? Yes. Okay, overall equality in general between men and women. Okay, good. What, anyone else? Okay, so those are pretty good definitions, actually. So pretty much, feminism is an ideology, and there's different definitions about what it entails, but feminism is pretty much the idea of trying to achieve political, economic, personal, and social equality of the sexes, of male and female together. Okay, so that's pretty much what feminism is. And the term feminism itself was coined in 1837, in France. It's called feminisme, or however you pronounce it. Sadly, my French is not good, even though I lived in France for 3 years. You have to pardon me for that. So it's something that has really been coined. Just the term itself is fairly new, in the past two centuries or so. And the feminist movement has focused primarily on trying to get women the right to vote, the right to hold public office, the right to work, the right to earn equal pay when they work, the right to own property, the right to receive education, the right to enter into contracts, the right to equal marriage rights. And in addition to that, different forms of feminism also try to legalize abortion so that women can decide whether they want to have a child or not, try to promote social integration so that there's no division between men and women in social spaces, try to promote change in dress and change in physical activity. This is kind of just in a nutshell what feminism is, and there's scholars of feminism or feminist theory, they classify the feminist movement into three different waves. Right? I'm not going to get into all of that stuff, to be honest with you, because it's going to get very theoretical, and we want to focus on something that's more practical in this talk. So let us talk briefly about who are feminists or where are the feminists. So that was interesting that in 2015, there was a poll done in different countries in the world, particularly developed countries. And they surveyed people and asked them whether you would define yourself as a feminist. And 18% of American women said that they would identify themselves as feminists. 18%. Right? So that's kind of surprising to a lot of people because you would think it would have been at 50%. Or you'd think it'd be at like at 70%. But instead, there was another question. They said, would you identify yourself as a feminist or would you identify that you believe in equality for women? So 85% of women, they said, we believe in equality for women, but we would not define ourselves as feminists. Only 18% of women in America define themselves as feminists. The same survey was done in Sweden, 36%, which was the highest rate that you find in any of the developed, quote unquote, developed countries. That define themselves as, women define themselves as feminists. 36% in Sweden, 31% in Italy, 29% in Argentina. I'm giving you these statistics so that you understand where the feminist movement is primarily active, where its ideological roots are, so it kind of gives you a perspective. Argentina, 29%, UK, 22%, Spain, 22%, Australia, 18%, Belgium 18%, France 18%. The lowest countries that they surveyed that where women said that they are feminists, they would identify as feminist, was Japan 8%, Germany 7%, and South Korea 7%. Right? So that's kind of gives you a little bit perspective on the background of where feminism is right now. At the same time, they surveyed men. And they asked how many men identify themselves as being feminists. So the numbers were slightly lower, but they were quite predictable. So if in America it was like 18% of women identify as feminists, it's like, you know, 10 to 15% of men would identify the same. If it's somewhere like 30%, the men would be like 15, 20%. Fairly predictable. The only one country that was surveyed that found the situation flipped was Poland, where 21% of men in Poland identified as feminists and only 17% of women identified as feminists. So more men identified themselves as feminists than women actually did. Right? So that's just kind of a little bit demographic survey of, you know, who ascribes themselves to feminism as a label. Even though most people are saying that they believe in the equality of women, but they wouldn't define themselves as feminist. Perhaps because they don't know what the term entails, like most of our audience, or they're not sure, or perhaps for some other reasons. Now, there are different forms of feminism, and I'm aware of that. So one of the other critiques that I get whenever I mention feminism is that, you know, you're only talking about one particular type of feminism, and that is the middle class white privileged feminism of women who live in the West. And there's different forms of feminism, and there's different, you know, understandings of what feminism is, and I understand that. There is Arab feminism, there is black feminism, there is a new thing called Islamic feminism. How Islamic it is debatable. And different, you know, forms of Latino or Latinx feminism, and all sorts of different, you know, categories. So I'm aware of that, right? So, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. And the reason why we're not talking about that tonight is because what I want to focus on is I want to focus on what feminism primarily is and not what it should be or what ideally it's supposed to be. And what that means is the most influential or the most powerful type of feminism that exists within the societies we're talking about, that's what I want to focus on. So black feminism may be a thing and it may be a movement, it may be something that people are developing, Arab feminism may be something, but Western white middle class feminism is the most powerful form of feminism that exists and has affected our society, in which the society in which we live in, and much of the world in a particular way. So that's why we're specifically focusing on that. So we could talk about an academic review or an academic study of all different feminist ideas, but what's gonna happen, and I'm being very careful on this topic because I know it's a very sensitive topic, okay? And you know, a lot of people came and said, you know, you're basically putting your neck under the guillotine, you know, by talking about this topic. Another sheikh told me you're walking into a landmine, you're gonna blow up. And I said, you know, may Allah consider me a martyr if that happens, you know, inshallah. No, but, and that sheikh just walked in the room. Anyways, so, all right, alhamdulillah, sorry sheikh. All right, so, and other people told me that, you know, you need to be really careful about this topic. I'm aware of that, okay? But this topic is very important to me as well. And I want you to understand why. It's because this is a topic that I've been, this is a topic that's affected me and I've been thinking about, you know, for the past 20 years. My coming back into Islam and actually taking Islam seriously, one of the impediments that drove me away from Islam, even though I grew up in a Muslim family, was Islam status when it comes to women. It was something that bothered me and it's something that bothers a lot of people, male and female, both. So for me, having an understanding of what Islam really says about women was a very important factor in my kind of having an appreciation and love and understanding of Islam. So this is a very important topic to me, and I just want to clarify that. So that's why I'm going to be very careful on this topic, but at the same time I'm talking about it. So what I'm gonna do, instead of just mentioning a bunch of different points that the feminist movement has and look at it as a whole, instead, because someone can come and critique and say, you know what? Oh, well, that's one form of feminism. You're not talking about the other form of feminism. Or why don't you talk about Arab feminism? Or why don't you talk about Keisha Ali? Or why don't you talk about what Amina Wadud is doing in her books? Or why don't you talk about, you know, Ayan Hirsi Ali's critiques of, you know, Islam? Or why don't you talk about all of these other things? I'm aware of these things. I read these things. This is my field. This is what I do. But instead of, you know, just to kind of avoid that, what I'm trying to focus on are books or ideas which have been influential in the minds of people in our society. And I wanna focus and limit my, restrict my subject to that specifically. So I'm gonna take a few books that are popular in the feminist movement. I'm gonna give some summary of some of those points. And then I'm gonna take some responses by Muslims who had some critiques or some, you know, ideas on feminism and how it relates to Islam, and I'm gonna summarize that, and that's pretty much what our lecture is gonna be for tonight, okay? And then we'll have a Q&A session. All right, so let's start with Mary Wollstonecraft. All right, she wrote a book called A Vindication of the Rights of Women. All right, has anyone read this book? One person only, two people? Three people. In class, was it required reading? Required reading, all right. Have any guys read this book? No, okay. All right, that's fine. So this was in 1792. So the book was written in England in 1792. It's considered to be one of the very early feminist texts. Technically, it's a proto-feminist text because feminism wasn't considered to be a movement at the time. But it's a text which inspired people from the feminist movement, and it was actually very well received when it was written. And there's some critique on that, but we can talk about that another day. So here is a summary of some of the points that she brings up. And I'm not going to give a detailed commentary on it. I'm going to allow our Muslim thinkers to give a commentary on the principles of how to address those. I just want us to understand what are the ideas that exist in the books which are inspiring feminist thinkers. Subhanallah. All right. And, you know, what can we do about it? So while before I begin talking about that, I want to explain something about computers to you, okay? So Dell has made a new computer which is very small in its form factor. It has a very nice shape. It's very portable. It has a great screen and everything. But one of the problems with that computer is that if you have a document open, you're in the middle of a khutbah, you're in the middle of a lecture, it will just randomly shut down and completely ruin the train of thought of the speaker, eliminate all of his notes. So one of the things I did was, because I'm a computer science major, I thought I'm smart, so I downloaded the software called Shutdown Blocker, which basically prevents your computer from shutting down. It'll actually stop it from shutting down. But what's really interesting is that this Shutdown Blocker software is actually garbage because it doesn't work, you know? And my computer just shut down. But the great thing about it is I know that this happens, so I know how to immediately load my notes back up and get right back into the subject. And I've actually had to do this in a khutbah where there was 5,000 people in the audience, and the notes just decided to immediately, the computer just shut itself down, but nobody noticed that I was restarting, the notes came back up, and alhamdulillah, everything was perfectly fine. You know, so this is the result of some practice that I have. So let's get back to Mary Wollstonecraft, okay? So in 1792, she writes this book. And some of the points that she mentions are, first of all, that there's a difference in education between men and women. Now understand, she's writing about England in the early, you know, late 18th century. So she writes that there's a difference in education between men and women. And she says why, she talks about that this is unfair, it's unjust, and this is in England. And she says, why do men and women have to have different characteristics in society? Why are they viewed differently? Why is there a differentiation between male and female in society? Then she talks about how women should be part of democracy in the sense that they should have a say in political affairs. They should be able to vote. Again, this is very early on, so you know, this is prior to the form of democracies that, you know, we understand them to be. But she's kind of hinting at these ideas. Then she says that women should not be looked down as second-class citizens, and that they are looked down in England during her time as second-class citizens. And she says one of the reasons why this is because of the Bible. She says the Bible has said that there's Adam and Eve was created from the rib of Adam. And that automatically puts her into a subservient state or a second-class state. And there's no work around this. If you accept the story of Adam and Eve according to the Bible, and from the Jew, you know, from the perspective of Judaism and Christianity, you're stuck into this idea that women are somehow second class and they cannot get out of this. Then she says, on top of that, women need to have, we need to kind of get beyond that. And women need to have a greater voice in literature. And the different standards that we have in society are unjust. So she starts talking about some of them. She says that if a woman expresses disagreement, it's considered unladylike in society. And therefore, this double standard needs to be eliminated. When she disagrees, she should be as potentially vocal or aggressive or whatever word you want to use. She should be able to disagree or have certain characteristics that men have rather than having this false notion of being ladylike, which should not necessarily exist within society. Then she says women deserve representation in government. Women, unfortunately, according to her, are taught to focus on beauty and grace. And this focus limits them in society and prevents them from achieving their full potential. She says that women do not have access to the same education as boys, which was true in that society. And she says, why should women not be able to study the exact same subjects as boys do in all aspects of education? They should study all the same subjects, and there's no reason why they shouldn't have exactly the same type of education. And she says, boys are raised differently than girls when they're children. So boys are told by their parents to go and play outside, and girls are told to stay inside and play with their dolls, right? So she says this is a double standard which needs to be eliminated. And she says one of the problems which it causes is that if women cannot go outside and play and get physical activity, they already have a physical weakness relative to man in terms of their body structure, in terms of their muscle development, muscle mass, and all of that. Now this will continue their physical weakness even more by not letting them go out and play while they're young, and then going and being involved in more, you know, grueling physical activities. And then she says, the idea of giving girls dolls when they're young, what it does, it actually tells them that beauty is the only thing that is important in society. And it, you know, pushes them in that particular direction. And therefore, we need to change the way in which we actually raise our kids in terms of what, whether we give dolls to our, you know, daughters, or whether we give, you know, guns or, you know, action figures or something like that to our boys. Again, keep in mind, this is 1798. So then she writes that men want to keep women as sex objects, or they want to keep women in control. So this is the primary mission or goal of many men in society. And she says this results in women being suppressed. She says getting a good husband in our society today means that you should be pretty and you should be docile. And if you have these two characteristics, you're going to be able to get a good husband. Then she says that women can sometimes be very sneaky and deceitful. And the reason why they're sneaky and deceitful and they can gossip and everything is because they don't feel that they're equal. And if we make them equal, then they will stop this sneaking around and gossiping and stuff like that. So that's a solution to that problem. That's why that problem exists. Then she says men treat women as a fashionable accessory, as something just on the side, right? And she said the solution to that problem is that men and women, when they're in a relationship, they need to have friendship. Friendship is the core or key to having a good relationship. And the only way they can ever be friends is if they're treated as being intellectual equals. And until that happens, they're not gonna be treated at that level. And then she says, one of the problems we have is prostitution. And if we have the intellectual development of women, there will actually be less prostitution, because now they will have opportunities for better jobs and they will not end up in prostitution jobs. And she says that there are double standards in our society. Another one of the double standards is that men are allowed to sleep around while women must be faithful. So the standard should be removed. There should not be this double standard. Now she doesn't exactly clarify which side she wants it removed to, but you know, I'm not gonna comment on that, but because there was a big controversy about her. What happened was, is that after she died, this is just a side note, I'm not making a point with this, but it's a side note, after she died, her book was very popular when it was written. And you wouldn't think it was popular because many people have a perception that 1790s in England, they would not accept these ideas. Actually, they were accepting these ideas and they were open to these ideas. The book was very popular at the time. But what happened was, after she died, her husband started publishing a memoir about her and saying things like, you know, what type of woman she was. And he was not trying to insult her. He thought he was doing her some service by saying, you know, this is the type of woman she was. She was adventurous and this and that. But instead, he revealed some things about her, that she had, you know, children out of wedlock, and she had a bunch of love affairs, and she had a bunch of these things. So what happened was that people who were respecting her, they lost respect for her, because they thought that that's too radical of a thing that, you know, she was engaged in. So she was not a role model for people. So for a long time, for about 100 years, people did not really give so much weight to her ideas once that information, you know, leaked out. But then after 100 years, then people kind of said, okay, let's go beyond that. We can go back to that idea. So anyways, side note. So then she says, if women were equals, this is a really interesting point, okay? They're all interesting, but this, I find this to be really interesting. Just understand the mentality. Despite all of the ideas she's coming with, right? They seem pretty modern. We're like, yeah, we agree with all of that. But she's still living in a certain context. So she says, if women were equals, they could better raise their children. And that better raising of children would actually improve society. So she said that educated women could actually, if women were educated, they could help children with their studies and with their homework. So there you don't need tutors anymore. So one of the things that used to happen in English society at the time is that these middle class or upper class women, they would have to hire tutors to go and teach the subjects, and the tutors are male because there's no female tutors because they're not studying. So she's saying if women would be more educated, then instead of hiring We don't have to hire tutors at all, because women actually have science, math, all of that knowledge, literature, and they could go and teach their own children, so we don't have to hire tutors anymore. Then she says, and again, this society has servants in it. So she says that if women were more educated, then they would be kinder to their servants in the household, especially in front of their children. So what happens is, she's saying that there's this rivalry between women in the household and their servants. And that's, she's saying there's something natural, and it's a long the explanation of that. But then she's saying that the women in the household feel that they need to exert their power over the servants to keep them in line. And she says, if the women had better access to education, they would be kinder to their servants, because they don't need to show their power over them, because their education would be the power over them. And then she says, this is going to affect the children, because the girls who are watching their mother treat servants bad, and the servant is taking care of the girl as well, the girls start to imitate that bad behavior of their mothers when they grow up. So she's saying, if we were to educate women, we would actually have this entire, you know, cycle, or this tangent of being able to solve this problem as well. And then the last thing she mentions, she has women, if they're educated, so the focus is on education here. She said, if women are educated, then they can start worrying about real issues, right? Like, they can start discovering things. They can invent things. They can come up and discover new cures for diseases and illnesses, and they can do so many other things which would be a contribution to society. Instead, what they're doing, because they're not doing that, is all they do is just focus on what they want to wear in the day, and they spend all of their time and energy and all of these other things, and they should be directed in this direction instead. So that's in a very old book, but a book which kind of inspired many feminist thinkers. Okay, so that's the first book. The next book, to summarize, is a book called The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir. I don't know if I pronounced that right again. My French is not good. But this was written in 1949. Okay, so fast forward several years. Okay, but technically, second wave feminism has not begun yet. So this, we're still talking about first wave feminism until now. Second wave is something in America, 1960s began. So some of the points that she mentions. Now you're going to see a radical departure from what our previous author was saying compared to what our current author is saying. So she says that the idea of womanhood is a product of cultural forces rather than an innate quality in people. What that basically means is that the idea of being a woman is something that is people are socialized into becoming a woman. Woman is not something that exists just there in reality. So you're going to see where she's going with this. She's going to say we need to modify that socializing so that womanhood becomes something different. So she's going to define what womanhood is according to her understanding in Western Europe, in particular in her area. So she says women have passive lives and they live in the shadow of men. And she says this has been the case throughout history in most societies of the world. The women are given a secluded domain where they're passive, and they're immersed in themselves. So the reason why they focus on themselves so much is because they've been secluded and they've not been allowed to go outside of this domain. And on the contrary, men are active, men are creative, they're productive, their efforts exert out there into the world and they have some effect on the world, and women don't have that same effect. And then she says human males are stronger because of the muscle mass and everything that they have. But these traits are only important in a society where strength, physical strength, is valued above everything else. But she's basically saying, we don't live in that society. The world has changed. And today the world has changed much more with technology and everything we have. Physical strength is not so much in just the muscle mass that you have as it was in some primitive society. She's saying that the world has changed, we need to acknowledge that change. And then she talks about a patriarchal society, and she says, what patriarchy means is that men occupy most positions of power in that society. And she says, but it's not always been that way. And again, I'm just telling you what she's saying, okay? I'm not commenting on it yet. She's saying, but in the past, women once wielded more power than men did in some societies. She says, women could women are the only ones who could have children. And because of the fact that they could have children, they were given a sacred status. So what happened was that there were some societies where you would actually take the mother's clan name instead of the father's clan name. And she's saying this is an example of where women were dominant in a society. She's saying there are societies where female gods or female idols were worshipped rather than male idols. And she says there are societies where men feared women rather than women fearing men. And then she says, but what happened was this patriarchy became established somewhere and the entire thing flipped. And it flipped so bad that male gods, male deities and idols like Zeus started overpowering or overshadowing even all the female deities. The entire thing just flipped around, and now we're in the situation that we're in. Then she says that patriarchy, this idea of men being dominant and in control of most positions of power, it is strengthened by two factors. One, by inheritance, and two, by marriage. So these two factors keep women subservient. She says, why? Because in the past, in some societies, property was held communally, meaning it doesn't belong to anyone. It's like a communism type of thing. Everyone owns the same type of property. But then property became privatized. And this was the worst thing that ever happened for women, because women were excluded from property rights and they were excluded from inheritance in many societies, right? And she's talking about Western Europe in particular as well. She's saying not having property will alienate women from society as a whole. And marriage will continue to dehumanize a woman by simply making her an asset. So what happens is that a woman is controlled by her father. And if her father is not alive, she's controlled by her eldest male relative. And then after she gets married, she's passed on to her husband, and then her husband will control her. And then she says, there was even a Greek custom called epiklarate, or I can't pronounce it right, which basically forced women to marry the eldest male in the husband's family if their husband actually passes away and dies. She's saying this is an effort to keep women in absolute control. And this is what happened and something that evolved. So she's saying, look, today, we're looking in the, you know, almost the 50s. She's saying, look, there are improvements today. Women are better off than they were in the past in all of these civilizations. 1949, she's writing. She says, there are improvements, but the subjugation of women continues. Women are not allowed to go to, you know, in the past, women were not allowed to go to university. Now they're allowed to go to university. It's progress. Women were not allowed into politics. Women are not allowed into politics. Progress. But then she says, by remaining unmarried, the women who were able to be powerful, by remaining unmarried, they were not subjugated by men. When their fathers died, when the male relatives died, and when either they didn't get married or their husbands died, that's when they were actually able to get their full freedom. Right. So then she says, in 1918, another example of, you know, where women are still subjugated or women are still treated unequally, in 1918 in America, she says, women earned half of what men earned, even if they were performing the exact same job. So if they're collecting the exact same amount of coal from a mine, they would get half the amount of money than a man would actually get. And of course, we can talk about how that still plays out today. And then she says, housewives were seen as unable, they were viewed, housewives are viewed as being intellectually incapable of doing any work outside. And then they're unpaid and they sit at home and they get stuck and they're viewed as being inferior beings as well. So then she comes back to the Bible and she says, much of the problems are resulting from the Bible. She says, once you accept the story of Adam and Eve, it degrades women. Eve is responsible for tempting Adam in the first place, which resulted in the entire fall of human beings to this earth. And therefore, from the Christian perspective, people have what's called original sin. And she says, the fact that people are born with sin is all the burden is actually placed on the woman, because she's the one who's responsible, who tempted Adam in the first place. So you can see her religious perspective on that as well. And then she says, but it's not just Christianity. There's so many myths about women across so many different cultures. So she said, even if you look at Greek mythology, not Christian, not Judaism, not you know, monotheistic. She says even the Greek muses, you know, the women who are singing and all that, it just shows the same myth that women basically are beings which can inspire, you know, production, but they cannot create anything in and of themselves. Basically what she's saying is that even the Greek mythology and putting the muses and what they're doing is inspiring men and all that, it's like today. You know, women are supposed to be cheerleaders for the football team or the basketball team, but they're not playing the sport themselves. Right? So she's saying even those things are myths, and that just degrades women further. And then she says another thing which degrades women further, she goes back to Christianity, and she says even the idea of Mary, Maryam, the mother of Jesus, is degrading because she has no individual contribution herself. Her contribution is delivering the child rather than actually having an independent contribution. Again, this is from her perspective. Okay, Islam has another perspective on this. But so she's saying, and Christians, keep in mind, Christian environment, they believe that this is God, you know, Son of God. So for them, this is like the most important thing, but she just, what is her role in that? It's almost like someone who's inspiring or a cheerleader or someone who's just producing, but there's no direct role in, you know, the most important person who was born for Christians. And then she talks about a few more points and then we'll kind of move on. She says that becoming a woman starts in childhood. So we need to rethink how we view childhood. Very similar to what our previous author was saying. She says that we divide boys and girls. And boys are told to be a man. No, who's heard of that before? Right? You heard that before. Be a man. What does that mean? It means be independent and be strong. And she says, but girls, they don't get that. They're treated like infants, like little babies for a longer period of time. And they're given more warmth and care and nurturing. And she's saying this isn't this results further perpetuates the subjugation of women. And then she says boys are allowed to urinate while standing up. And this gives them a sense of agency. And the fact that they have agency, they actually become more empowered. And women, they have to sit down or they have to squat. And they have to do it in, they're taught to like cover themselves up rather than expose themselves. So that, you know, what we call in Islam, haya kind of thing. Like, you know, you should be a little bit, you know, having some shame when it comes to that. What it does is, it actually instills the idea into women that their sex organs are taboo. And actually it causes them to become more ashamed of their body when they grow up. And he says, the boy has a penis. And he has... This is interesting. So the boy has a penis to play with, okay, when he's a boy. But the girl has nothing. So what does she do? She ends up getting a doll. And having a doll signifies that she should be like her mother and she should start preparing for taking care of children when she gets elder. And she says all of this that we have from the physical characteristics of boys and girls to the type of toys we give them, to the type of, you know, manner in which we treat them, all of this contributes to the subjugation of women at the end of the day. And then she says, when girls become adolescent and they start to grow up, they realize that their mother's role is confined and that their mother is subjugated. So they want to be in their father's role. So she said that the statistic was performed during her time. And she said that they asked and they checked how many boys wanted to be girls. It's 1949. What percentage do you think it was? 1%. All right. How many girls wanted to be boys? 75%. All right. So totally different statistic. And then she continues on and she says it just continues. The burden continues for women. The fact that women have breasts is a further burden for her. It's a physical discomfort and all things. The fact that she has to menstruate and she has a period, it becomes a further burden for her. Right? And then it continues on and on. So you can kind of see some of her ideas and how they've been influential in shaping, you know, the hearts and minds of people. Okay? Now, let's look at the next book real quick. So we're going to summarize because we're running out of time here. So the next book is The Feminine Mystique, okay, by Betty Friedan. So I'm sure some of you have definitely read this book because it's a very popular book. This was written in 1963, And this book basically sparked what's called second wave feminism in the United States. This was the best-selling nonfiction book, over a million copies sold in 1964, and a lot of people, you know, have read this book. So basically, okay, I'm just going to summarize in a nutshell. What this is basically saying is she's speaking to American housewives, okay? And she's saying that, she specifically says that in 1949, after World War II, fulfillment as a woman had only one definition for American women after 1949, and that is the housewife mother. So the only concept of fulfillment was the housewife mother for American women. But if you go back to the 20s and 30s, it was different. So this baby boom generation that we're talking about, she's saying you can, basically the summary is, you cannot ever be fulfilled by simply being a housewife. You're tricking yourself. You yourself are not only being subjugated, but there's no ultimate purpose. You need to do something above and beyond that. So a very influential book as well. We won't go into it in detail because we need to move on to the next part. So, next part. So these are some Islamic responses from different Muslim thinkers. Okay? One of them, I could not find her picture, unfortunately, but Dr. Lois Lamia Faruqi. Has anyone heard of her before? I knew you had heard of her. You're the only one. I knew you'd be the only one. So, all right. Anyways, alhamdulillah. So, yeah, I remember reading her book, Cultural Atlas of Islam. It's an amazing book. She's the husband of Dr. Ismail Raji Faruqi. They're both, you know, amazing intellectuals, and both of them, unfortunately, were killed. And it's suspected that they were martyred for their political views on Palestine specifically. So may Allah, you know, grant them paradise. So she was a really gifted woman. I couldn't find her picture for some reason. So she wrote an article called Islamic Traditions and the Feminist Movement, Confrontation or Cooperation, which is basically where I just stole the title from her for my own presentation. All right, so she mentions a few things in here reflecting on the feminist movement around the world, and she has some commentary on that. So she's saying, first of all, that Muslim women are disappointed or they openly reject certain parts of the feminist movement. And she's saying, why is that? She said, the reason why, she's writing kind of to the Western world, saying, you need to understand what Muslim women really think, or in her idea, maybe should think, about feminism. You guys need to understand before you take your feminist movement program and try and implement it on Muslims around the world, you need to understand why there's some hesitation here. Either we don't like some of the ideas or we completely reject some of the ideas. And she says that's because we have an Islamic culture which has social, psychological, and economic culture or traditions built into it. And if you don't take that into consideration, there's going to be a mismatch between these two movements here. So you saw kind of how the movements were, you saw what religion, their perspective on religion, their perspective on Adam and Eve, their perspective on certain things. So now she's going to offer a critique. And she says, the first point we need to understand is that Islam promotes a family system. So the family system in Islam is advocated to the extent that they're supposed to be a large extended family, and family values are supposed to not only be in the nuclear family, not only husband, wife, and kids, but in the extended family. Your parents and your grandparents and your uncles and your aunts and everyone, they matter. She says there's a very big difference between focusing purely on the nuclear family and focusing on the extended family. And in a Muslim culture or in an Islamic culture, that is going to affect some of the ideas that are coming in there. And she says it's very clear cut from the Quran, from the Hadith, what Islam says about family. So instead of quoting all of that, we'll just talk about that as a point. She says the family system is very different in the works of, or the view of the family system. Even in the feminist thinkers who believe in family, they're still thinking of nuclear family. And they're not so much focusing on the extended family. And then she says that family participation in marriage is something which is encouraged in Islam. So this is interesting. So she says that feminists, they will restrict, they think that family participation in marriage will restrict individual freedoms because someone else is coming and telling you what to do or advising you what to do. But Dr. Faruqi says, no, Dr. Faruqi says that the family participation in marriage is actually advantageous to the individual and it's advantageous to society, assuming you're not part of a dysfunctional family, okay? Assuming your family is not broken and all messed up. So he says, why is that? He says, number one, marriages are going to be based on sounder principles than simply the rule of attraction, right? So when you're getting interested in marriage, your family is going to give you good advice on what type of person you should be trying to marry. So it's not just between you and that individual. You're going to be thinking that, hey, I have to think what type of person I'm going to marry and how that's going to affect my greater family. It's not just between two people, right? That's a good point. Number two, the family will support the new couple. Not only financially, they'll support them, you know, emotionally, they'll support them in so many different ways, but obviously financially would be one of the important things that we even see today. Whereas you see in the absence of family, people cannot get married because they cannot afford marriage. The family is not willing to support for whatever reason. Number three, she's saying that you have social interaction built in so that people do not end up becoming lonely. So this happens to a lot of couples. And we do a lot of, you know, we see a lot of couples come in and they say, you know, as soon as they get married, the woman goes her own way or she's sitting at home and the guy goes and he's traveling on business trips. The woman is sitting there lonely and she has no extended family to, you know, help her out and just prevent her from being lonely, or even vice versa and the guy starts becoming lonely and all that. So number four, spouses will actually be kept in line due to opposition from a larger group. And she's alluding to the verse of the Quran, which says if there's a conflict between spouses, you have one person from one side of the family come, another side of the family come. She's saying that what's going to happen is there's always going to be conflict in marriage. Okay, but when that conflict comes, assuming the families, again, are not dysfunctional, right? They will come because they have a vested interest of keeping this family together. So they will come in and they will put people in their place when they need to, and say, you know, you need to just, you know, stop being petty or whatever it is, as long as it's not like on a serious issue. So he's saying the opposition from a larger group is going to help the spouses keep themselves in line when they're fighting. Number five, children will be taken care of when they're working. So if a woman is even working and a man is working and they're both working and they have children, the extended family will be there to take care of them. You got the grandparents there, you got some uncles there, you got other people who may not be out. There's always someone to go and take care of the rest of the family. And then number six, she says the larger social unit in the case of divorce, in the case of family breakdown, the larger social unit of the family will actually absorb the effects of that divorce on the spouse as well as on the kids. So a spouse will start getting depressed, I'm divorced, this and that. The family's there. Whatever it is, the guy will go back to his family, girl will go back to their family. Let's assume that's the case. They're gonna be that support system for them. And in terms of the children as well. So if a woman needs to go and let's say she has to fend for herself or work, whatever, the family's there to be there and to take care of her. And you know, help with the kids and all of that stuff. She's saying that is one very important difference between the feminist discourse on family or on individual rights or even on the nuclear family versus the extended family. And the next point she mentions is she says that the idea of individualism versus the larger organization. So she says Islam channels individual goals of people into the goals for the greater welfare of the larger group. And she says you don't see this in the ideology of feminism for the most part. So what does that mean? What she's saying is that it's not about individual fulfillment. It's not about what makes me happy and what makes me fulfilled and what brings my success. It's not from an individual context. But instead, Islam takes the individual goals that you may have and they have to be channeled into a greater goal for a family, whether it's a nuclear family or an extended family as a whole. And she's saying what happens is that a female's goals on an individual level, they may be in line with the benefits of the family, or maybe they have to be subordinate to the actual goals of the group. So what she's saying is that from an Islamic perspective, you may have to sacrifice for the benefit of your family, And that is not opposed to fulfillment or fulfilling a particular goal. Whereas in feminism, because the focus is primarily on the individual, why would you sacrifice your individual goals or individual fulfillment for the greater good of the family? There's no sacrifice needed. And of course, it's the same for men. So she's saying that perspective is radically different, and that leads to different conclusions. And then she says that the promotion of individual goals can actually threaten the social interdependence that Islam is trying to bring. Okay, so that's individuals versus the larger family unit organization. Then she says the idea of differentiation of sex roles. Okay, so from this, she's saying that male and females in Islam, they have different roles. And then she just alludes to this, and she doesn't really build on it, and she says it is both natural and it's desirable. Right? And if we have time, I'm going to talk about the natural part in the next thinker. If not, we'll just skip him. But she says it's natural and it's desirable. So she's saying two things. One, the fact that there are different roles for men and women, it's the way which human beings are built. And number two, it's actually desirable. Whereas you find, like, for example, the other books, we're talking about how there's disadvantageous traits that women will have. She's saying, no, actually, when you have different roles, we're actually designed to complement one another, and that's something that's good. So she says that the feminine ideal, or the feminist ideal, is a unisex society where there's a single set of roles and a single set of concerns that are given precedence, and everyone should have the same goals and the same concerns and the same roles. And she says the feminist movement gives preference to traditional male roles of financial support, career success, and decision making. She's saying, well, what happens in Western feminism, the one that we're talking about here, she's saying, if everyone is supposed to be in the same role, they're supposed to have the same goals, the same values, and going towards the same direction, she's saying, which, in Islam, if there's different roles generally that are assigned, which traits are given precedence in Western feminism? She says these three, and these are traditionally the male roles. So they're given precedence over the other roles, which are the domestic matters, childcare, aesthetics, social relationships, etc. She says what happens is the women's traditional roles become either devalued or they become despised and they're looked down upon. And then therefore they're not an actual goal to try and strive to get to. Instead, women should try to get to the male, traditional male roles, and that's where their success actually lies. And then she says, men and women are being forced into a single mold, whereas in Islam, both of these roles equally deserve respect. One is not seen as superior than the other. In fact, they're seen as complementary, and they're seen both as being praised, and one is not superior to the other. But from the Western feminist framework, one of them is viewed as being categorically superior to the other, whether it's power or whether it's money or whether it's, you know, all of these things that we mentioned. Then she says that having a division of labor along sex lines is actually beneficial to the larger group. Meaning having this division of labor is beneficial to the greater group, which is the family as a whole. She says the roles of men and women are equal, but they're not identical. And she says when they become identical, there is a green light for competition rather than for complementing one another. And then intercompetition happens within the spouses. And then she says economic responsibilities differ. And the reason why they differ is because reproduction and child rearing differ. They only apply for women. So she's saying that women are not equally responsible economically because, you know, the fact that women are not equally responsible economically is not a type of gender inequality. But instead, it's a type of compensation for another duty, and that is the child rearing and the services and all of the other thing that she's talking about. And then she talks about inheritance. And inheritance, one of those things that we can't, you know, even talk about this topic without, you know, usually getting into that. So she says that the inheritance rates in Islam and the inheritance rates that exist in the Quran, they're part of a comprehensive system of male financial responsibility. And you have to understand them from the whole perspective. Okay, so just to give you some insight in here, you know, people have this perception that women always get less than a man gets in inheritance. That's not the case. You know, we have a class on inheritance, you know, in our school, California Islamic University. And when you study inheritance, it's not always the case. So let's give an example. A woman dies, she leaves a husband, a father, and a daughter. Two males, one female. Okay? The husband will get 1/4 of her inheritance, the father will get 1/4 of her inheritance, the daughter will get half of her inheritance. So in this case, just one random example, the daughter will actually get double the inheritance of the two males which were surviving here. So it's not always the case, but it's the case when there's a daughter and there's a son from the same, blood distance from the person who passed away, the deceased. I'm getting tired now. So the person from the deceased. So it's considered to be half. So you say, well, why is it half? Why does a son get double the share of inheritance than a woman? She says, you have to understand this in the context that this son is supposed to be financially responsible. When he gets married, he's financially responsible for his household. When the woman gets married, she's not financially responsible for a household. And we can continue to, you know, reflect upon that for a long time. But she makes that point. And she says, if you don't see it as a whole, you're not going to understand what the rules are. So then she comes to the solution. And she says, okay, what is the solution to this dilemma? She says, should we maintain the status quo that exists in Muslim societies today? And she writes a giant no way, right? Which basically means that she's saying that no, the Muslim countries or the Muslim lands, they are not representing Islamic ideals by any means at all, right? So they are not good role models or examples to look at in terms of what we're trying to actually achieve. But some of the things we need to understand, she says, first of all, that the idea of a separate legal status for women, which was part of the first wave feminist movement, which we talked about in some of the earlier writings here, she says that is something that Islam has already given to women when the Quran was first revealed. So she has a separate identity, she has the right to own property, she has the right to contract, she has the right to earn. Her marriage does not affect her legal status. If there's a crime, her criminal penalties are equal to the same criminal penalties that exist for a man. All of that stuff has been equal, whereas in Western Europe, where feminism was originating and being developed, it was not the case. So he said, we need to go back and we need to understand, first of all, a lot of these ideas, right, were particular to one part of the world, or maybe different parts of the world, but Islam didn't really have that issue. Then she addresses the issue of polygyny or polygamy. We're going to skip that for now because it's going to become very long. And then she gives some tips for women's rights workers. So she says, look, those people who are working for women's rights, here's something you need to keep in mind. She says, Islam gave women many of the first wave rights, first wave feminism. So these things tend to generally be irrelevant for Muslims. So that's one thing we need to understand. And then she says, the second thing you need to understand is you need to look at the other goals of the second wave feminism. And third wave is just a reiteration of second wave, saying that it has not been achieved. So some goals are diametrically opposed to Islamic values and they should never be accepted and they will never be accepted. So the more you try to implement that on Muslims, they're not going to accept those things which are not part of, part of the Islamic ethos or the Islamic, foundational understanding. And then she says that there's an intercultural incompatibility between the idea of feminism and the perception of Islam when it comes to women, their rights, their status, their perspective, and the idea of family. She's saying that feminism was conceived in the West, and the primary goal was to remove the legal impediments that existed in England and in France and in other parts of the world. And she says most of the laws were derived from Christianity. They were derived from a feudal system. And then there was an industrial revolution that took place. Women were needed in the workforce. And according to her, the reason why most of those changes happened, those changes took place, was because of that industrial revolution and the fact that women were needed. It was not just something where people's moral sentiments somehow shifted or changed, but they were actually needed for a particular purpose, and that's why the laws began to change as well. So then she says, what would an Islamic feminism actually look like? She says, feminism has viewed religion as the main opponent of its progress, as you've seen in the story of Adam and Eve and Mary and all of these critiques. And she says, but Islam needs to be viewed as the ally to actually achieve some of the goals that were there. And we should not somehow all of a sudden put Islam, you know, on trial and think that all of a sudden Islam is somehow a problem, the way that Judaism and Christianity was a problem for people who were fighting for women's rights as being part of the feminist movement. And then she mentions another point at the end, and she's just about done here. And she says, feminism should not chauvinistically work for women's interests only. Now, this is a very important point. Feminism should not chauvinistically work for women's interests only, but it should align with the wider interest to support society as a whole. And this is very important because her dichotomy between individualism and between the greater social unit, whether it's family or something greater, it's not just what is good for you, it's what is good for a larger unit, and then we can define what those units are. And she concludes by saying that from an Islamic perspective, society is seen as an organic whole. And she's referring to a hadith, which basically says if one part of the ummah is suffering, one part of the community as a whole is in pain or something's going on, the entire body suffers and feels that pain. So she says we need to, you know, rethink the way in which we view things from an individualist perspective, and we look at them from a holistic perspective. So she's basically saying that, in a nutshell, that Islam and feminism is kind of like a Venn diagram. I didn't put one of these slides in here, but it's like there's overlap. And she's saying that overlap, there's some things which are outside in the realm of feminism that are outside the realm of Islam. And then there's things which are overlap. But she's warning people and saying, before we adopt a philosophy like this in toto, completely, we need to be very cognizant of what Islam is teaching, what Islamic values are, and what is the feminist movement actually talking about specifically. Right? So we're running out of time, unfortunately, so I should have prepared better. That's my fault. So I wanted to actually talk about another author, who is Professor Tim Winter from Cambridge University. He's a Muslim scholar. He's a sheikh as well. He wrote an article. That picture just looks a little strange, so I put another slide in there. So he wrote an article called Boys Will Be Boys, Gender Identity Issues. And this is a really interesting article. The summary of this article basically is that there was a woman by the name of Germaine Greer. Anyone read Germaine Greer? Nobody? Okay, so she wrote a book called The Female Eunuch, Eunuch, in 1969. Anyone know what a eunuch is? Am I pronouncing it correctly? Someone who's castrated. A eunuch, yeah. Eunuch? Eunuch, yeah. The female, someone who's castrated. So she's basically saying that, you know, females are, you know, kind of, society has basically castrated women to become subservient and to become sexless. And then she defines what that is. But what's really interesting, so this, I'm gonna summarize real quick what his thing is, otherwise I could go for another hour or two. She wrote that in 1969. In 1999, she wrote another book called The Whole Woman. And she's a very, you know, very important woman in the feminist movement in the 60s. She wrote a book called The Whole Woman in 1999, where she critiqued her former self. And she says, 30 years ago, I've been propounding these ideas. And you know what? We were mistaken about one particular thing. And that is the idea of equality feminism. There's something instead called difference feminism, where we need to acknowledge and accept that men and women now are proven biologically, proven neurologically to be different from males. And people in the past didn't know that. Freud did not have the science and the technology to figure that out. Marx did not have the science and technology to figure that out. When David Hume and Thomas Paine were writing about egalitarianism, they did not have the understanding to figure that out in terms of conclusively prove it. And she's saying, now we've proved it. So we need to change our discourse and our understanding of what feminism is. And there's this new movement that she kind of has become part of, what's called difference feminism. Some of you may have heard of it or whatever it is. So what Dr. Winter is arguing in the very long article and essay that he writes is that there is a congruence or there's a compatibility between what Islam is saying about men and women and what this new age difference feminism or the revised feminism that people are kind of starting to gravitate towards, there's a congruence between the two of these, and we should investigate that in more detail. Okay, so maybe we can have a seminar on this someday, because it's definitely longer, but open it up for a few questions, inshallah ta'ala. Yes, bismillah. Sure. Dr. Murad or Dr. Winter is 2001. If you just type boys will be boys, gender identity issues, you'll find it. If you type the title of Dr. Lamia, Islamic Traditions and the Feminist Movement, you'll find it as well. So if you want to find it, you can find it on Google. You couldn't find it? Email me. Okay. I can look it up for you. I don't know the year of this one, but I can look it up for you. I think she was assassinated in the 90s, late 90s, I believe. So it's probably somewhere before that. But I can look it up for you, inshallah. Any other questions? Huh? Before the 90s? In the 80s? SubhanAllah. Early 80s, SubhanAllah. Yeah. They were really amazing couple. They've produced a lot. Any other questions? I've never had a talk with so few questions at the end. Either you're being courteous and nice to me, or... Okay, khair. Okay, if anyone does want to discuss it, if anyone does, again, I mentioned, if anyone disagrees, if anyone is going to be like, you know what, we're never going to attend a talk by this sheikh ever again in our life, you know, I'm open to critique, I'm open to meeting with you. 1986? She died in 1986? Okay. Jazakumullah khairan. So I'm open to that. We can make an appointment. We can talk about it, inshallah. Otherwise, would anybody be interested in attending like a full seminar on feminism? Yes? Just raise your hand. Would any men be interested in that? Okay, so maybe we can organize it. What would it, 3 hours, 6 hours, 9 hours? What works for you? Huh? I mean, I could go for, you know, I've read a lot on this subject, and this is a very important subject for me. I've been reading for 20 years on this. So, 2-day seminar or 1-day seminar? I'm getting no's, I'm getting a... 2, all right. What happens is people don't make it past the first day, and then the second day is empty. So, inshallah, we'll organize a 1-day seminar on this, inshallah ta'ala, all right? May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us to understand what is correct and true and help guide us towards that. Ameen. Subhanakallahumma bihamdik, nastaghfirukallah wa natubu ilayk. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.